This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to By the Book. I'm Lee Chui Lin. And as always, with me, my fellow journeyer through stories, journeywoman through stories, really, Sharmila Ganesan.
Hello.
Today, we also have a very special guest with us in our latest installment of our little book club
our
that we like to do.
Yes. So this is February.
Yes. We have Lim Suan. Suan, welcome.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
Lim Suan is my co-team member from the Bigger Picture team.
Yes, of course.
And he has been co-opted into this with us.
No, you know, we have to stop using that kind of language.
This is true. This
Juliet
is true.
Jacobs was last on and implied that she had a bit of a twisted arm situation, and that's not the case.
So in this case, actually, this whole sequence of events was actually inspired by Suan herself, who very, very highly recommended a particular book by an author. And so we decided that we would pick another book by the same author to do for the book club. Mm-hmm. Suan, you want to tell us about said author?
Said author. So the author is Naomi Novik. And I did read, so I initially started by reading her book, Uprooted. And then I was telling you about it. And I think I got a few of our, I spoke to a colleague who had read it as well. And then sort of like passed the book on to
she
other
went
colleagues.
Went viral in the office.
Yes. created a sensation a bit. And then I was talking to you about it. And then that's when you suggested that we read this other book by Naomi Novik. And that's where we ended up.
Yes. And that book is called Spinning Silver, and it was actually it was one of the finalists for last year's Hugo Award for Best Novel, and one of the reasons that I actually had been wanting to read it is because it was constantly being promoted as a retelling of the Rumpelstiltskin story, which is one of my favorite fairy tale stories of all time.
Yeah, so today we're talking about Spinning Silver, right? Which is that you know, so here's the thing. I came into this after this whole slightly viral sensation thing that you guys are describing, you know, where there's already. So here's what I was promised. Let's start with that. Here's what I was promised. I was promised that this is going to be an easy read. I was promised that this is going to be a retelling of a fairy tale and sort of set in a more fantastic, you know, sort of speculative fiction sense. And so I was all ready for that. I love that style of writing. I'm all for it. And I will say that by the time I finished the book, I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. But perhaps because of what I was told the book was, I would say the first maybe 50 or 60 pages were tough going.
I think I share some similarities with you there, because I read Uprooted first and then I really, really enjoyed that. That was quite a quick read for me. I finished that in like a day and a half. It was, you know, really fun. It was quite fast, action paced. And then so I went to this sort of, I guess, expecting the same, right? Because you would generally think that, you know, different the same author would write in a similar way. But I did find it a bit tougher to read as well. Like, I really enjoyed the story, how, you know, she wove the Rumpelstiltskin fairy tale into this, but it felt just that little bit slower compared to Uprooted.
I must say it did take me a while to finish the book. And in some ways, it wasn't what I might have sold to you initially, Lynn.
You both did it.
Because I also thought it was one of those kind of, and also it's marketed as being YA as well. So that's the other reason why. And again, not to put down the genre, but I always associate that with maybe being a little bit easier to get into. And this wasn't, in fact, like even within the first couple of chapters, to me, it started feeling more like a fantasy, almost an epic, where this could go on and it could have a huge sort of world building element behind it. And there was a lot. You're actually thrown into a, I suppose, an Eastern European fantasy setting where, you know, there are villages, and then there are these like mysterious worlds that exist in the periphery, and you hear about beings that have their own sort of civilization and the clash between. So really, it's not a breezy book in that sense. But I didn't find it difficult. I found myself being drawn into the story fairly quick, even from the beginning.
So I think that there are a number of sort of cultural, I wouldn't say hurdles, but cultural elements that you need to get accustomed to right from the get. And part of that is, like you said, not just the feudal setting, but even the way that people are addressed. So Panov and Panova, things like that. the beings that you're alluding to are, of course, the Staric, or Staric, the sort of winter...
Sort of like a combination between the elves from Lord of the Rings and the White Walkers from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
They have their own role.
Yeah. And they basically bring winter, or they create winter and have the power to make winter last forever, which obviously in a feudal society that relies on agriculture is very bad.
Yes, and they sort of come in and raid the villages as well. You know, they're sort of painted as this terrifying beings that people, you just want to avoid them, that if you see them coming, you do not want to be in their path.
And in the midst of all this, you also have the human characters, right? You've got Miriam, who is... a moneylender's daughter who tires of being poor and decides to take on the role of moneylender herself.
And a Jewish moneylender.
Importantly.
Yeah, very importantly.
Yes. And who lives on the periphery of the village, who's who has this, I suppose, core of anger, you know, at always being looked down upon, at always being... At her father for not collecting the money, for allowing them to live in poverty. And so that sets up this idea of the value of money and of gold and of silver. And of, that's a very important thing.
And this theme of a debt paid, a debt owed and a debt paid, which is something that runs very strongly throughout the book and really starting the book off with Miriam and that feeling of both the shame and the power that you have when someone owes you something is very important that we start that way, because really that is the core of what the rest of the book runs on.
And then very quickly you're also introduced to Wanda as well, who is the daughter of whose father actually owes Miriam and her father money, and then so in return for that debt, I think Wanda is sent to work for Miriam, and then you don't really see a friendship forming, but there's sort of that, like, I'm working for you, and they're slowly getting to know each other, but not really either. It's not, I guess at the start of the story, I was expecting that this would turn into your usual friendships in your book, but it's not, right? It's sort of, again, that debt owed and a debt paid.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, Suan, because then there's the third female character, and really those are the three women that we, or young women that we kind of follow through the book, and that's Irina, who's the daughter of a duke. And kind of lives fairly removed from these two other girls. And at some point, they come into contact. The book doesn't really seem very interested in building, as you would expect, a relationship between the three of them.
There is no girl power moment.
No. But instead, it is this idea of an almost functional relationship between everyone, and this questioning of when a relationship is sort of crosses from being functional to being a real relationship. Mm. And I found that quite fascinating.
All of which to say, I think, you know, everything we're describing, this book is a very emotional book, but also a very cold one. Or at least that's how I found it. Because, like you said, there are no... if there are embraces, if there are expressions of love, they happen within the family setting. So it's very, very clear that with the Jewish moneylender family in particular, while others might look at them and see nothing more than that, they are bonded to one another. They're incredibly close. They love one another. They take care of one another. But the relationships, generally speaking, within the book are very, functional, transactional. It takes a while to build levels of trust. And you have to just kind of go along for that ride. Mm-hmm. And I think that was something that it took that took me a while to get into, because I was sitting there thinking, when are people going to meet? You know, how is this all going to coalesce? And feeling that way ever more so because the chapters are told from the Game of Thrones style eye perspective, minus the Game of Thrones style clarity of having the person's name.
Yeah.
So, you know, the first few sentences of any given chapter, I think you're busy thinking, Irina?
Did that work for you guys?
I really, really enjoyed it when we started to get the point of view from characters that you didn't expect, which happened, I think, in the second half of the book. You know, at the start, it's really Miriam and Wanda for a long period of time. And then suddenly Irina comes in with no explanation of why suddenly there's a duke's daughter.
And then suddenly you have Wanda's brother. So I think
Step On.
Particularly, yeah. You had quite a few chapters yeah. from him, and then
then you have Irina's nursemaid,
yes.
Magretta.
Yes. Yeah. And you also, I think, get that point of view from characters that you don't expect,
yes.
who you perhaps didn't view as point of view characters, and that I really loved.
Yeah.
So when that happened, I was like, oh, now we're talking,
and sort of inserted quite cleverly at a point where it really does. What's it called? A deus ex machina?
Yeah.
But not in a negative way. In that it's brought in at a point where it does turn the story in a very particular mm-hmm. way for you. And I enjoyed that. I thought it was very clever as well. Mm.
But did we find it distracting? I think before it got good. And the question here is, before it got good and meaningful, this idea of the point of view chapters, did it work?
See, I found that at first I was fine with it because, like you said, Lynn, it was at first just Wanda and Miriam. So it was quite easy to see that sort of switch between the two of them, right? And I think what Naomi Novik does really well is that after that first paragraph or two, you can figure out who it is. Quite quickly, you can get it. But it's still quite jarring when suddenly a new character is introduced in it and then you have no idea who that person is at first. And then that's just that few moments where you're trying to figure out where this fits in the story, whose perspective you're reading it from, because you really feel that perspective change, right? Because each person has their own personality, has their own way of seeing things. So like when you're reading it from Magretta's perspective, the nursemaid, it's very different. She thinks of Irina very fondly versus when you're reading from Irina's perspective, sometimes it's a bit more, it's colder, it's a bit more calculative what she plans to do next.
I think I have a weakness for this structure of storytelling, because we had the same discussion when we did Celestial Bodies for Book Club, where it had that switching perspective, and I very much enjoyed it, whereas you and Sumitra were like, it took us a while to warm up to it. I liked it a lot, and I often admire the writer's skill to do exactly that, to within the first few sentences or paragraphs clue you in into whose head you're in. So I thought that was one of the strengths of this book, really.
I think it is too. And that doesn't mean, however, that I enjoyed it, I think, as much as you did. So I think it's one of those things where, because the book was so removed, I felt removed from it, you know? And that doesn't mean that I can't enjoy it or appreciate it for what it is. But it does mean that this is one of the first few book clubs where I feel like I'm really talking about a book and not an experience. I don't know how else to describe it, but that's how it's sitting with me. So in today's book club, this month's book club rather, we are focusing on Naomi Novik's Spinning Silver, which is a story that I would say is structured around the concept of Rumpelstiltskin more than it is a retelling of the actual fairy tale. If you've read it, if you like fairy tale retellings, we'd like recommendations, you can weigh in. You can WhatsApp us, of course, at 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Hello, you are listening to Buy the Book with Lynn Sharmila, and today our book clubber, Suan, who recommended Naomi Novik's Spinning Silver, which is the book that we're discussing. So as we kind of laid out earlier, we've talked about the kind of the three main characters, how the book is structured on a more point of view sort of setting. And that's been it. But I think we're not maybe giving the full scope of the story, because the thing about it is that Rumpelstiltskin was never a world ender in the same way that, I don't know, the Avengers are, right? Like everything is always about the world ending. Fairy tales tend to be a lot smaller. They tend to be about the damage to a family, the damage to a town. And I think that Spinning Silver starts off with you thinking that it's just going to be about damage to a family, and then quickly spirals out from there to, you know, that world-building quality we were talking about.
I think it was, that took me by surprise, honestly, because it was sold so strongly, unlike Uprooted, where it wasn't marketed as a particular fairy tale being retold. Because this one, I kept reading Rumpelstiltskin, and so I kept wondering in the first few pages. I could see strains of it, like basically the money-lending part, for instance. But it's only as the book unfolds that I started realizing how what Naomi Jamie Novick does is more take the underlying concepts or mm-hmm. the principles of the original fairy tale, things like the idea of spinning gold from straw. So that gets subverted quite cleverly in this book. But more importantly, also the power of your name.
Yes.
That idea of you know, concealing what your true name is. And also the question of that idea of you can make, I think in the original Rumpelstiltskin, or at least one of the versions, the miller's daughter every night can make three guesses as to his name. That kind of gets changed into a particular person gets to ask three questions every mm-hmm. night to someone. And even directly reference the miller's daughter as a local legend.
Like a meta fairy tale.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. So I actually really enjoyed it. I might have enjoyed it. I actually think I enjoyed this version of a loose retelling more than I might have a straight up, like, here's Rumpelstiltskin retold.
Yeah, and I think also because it's sort of spread out between the characters as well. There's no one single figure that is Rumpelstiltskin. Mm-hmm. In fact, Rumpelstiltskin doesn't really exist in here. And it's just you get elements that are part of one story and then elements that are part of another story. But it all comes together quite beautifully. And then there's some things that you don't realize that actually happened until the end. And I think that was very clever because a lot of times, like you said, Shamila, it's just a straight up retelling of it. You know, you make a bit of twist here, you make a bit of a change there, but you still get that same basic idea. So this, what I thought this was really clever.
Yeah, and I think another part of it that differs, or that differs from a straight up retelling, and that also has similar threads with other modern versions of fairy tales, is the fact that it is fundamentally modernized. Because, of course, in fairy tales, girls are often
yes.
meant to be saved, or they save themselves through virtue. You know, they have to be very good. They have to be virtuous and kind. And, you know, they have to have fed the correct cat at the correct gate. And then that cat turns out to be a prince and so on and so forth.
A wonderful daughter who yes. did everything she was supposed to do.
Precisely. Like, it's piety, virtue and kindness. That's how, and telling the truth, that's how you win the game. In fairy tales when you're a girl. But these three characters are actually very, very different. So Miriam is wonderful. Miriam's just, you know, not a very likable person and happy to be unlikable. She's just like, I don't have to, you guys don't owe me anything but money. You know, I don't care for you. And then you have Irina.
Importantly, because I know you don't care for me.
Yeah.
That was a strain that the Jewishness of it comes into the play there, because these are people that the rest of the village or town looks at as, oh, you know, as historically they were the moneylenders.
Exactly.
That's all you are.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I really like Miriam as a character.
And then you have Wanda, who is sort of this more, this seemingly sort of hardworking, silent girl. But underneath all that, there are all these strains of her trying to break free from the bonds of her life, you know, trying to not just be a piece of property to her abusive dad, you know, trying to be more than that, learning to read, you know, just all these elements in Wanda's story. And then Irina, who was never more than, I suppose, a disappointment because she was neither beautiful enough nor a son, you know, for her father, and showing this, like, steely intelligence, and none of them fundamentally do anything to be liked. You know, they just sort of exist.
No, yeah. And I read in a particular article about the book that all three women are allowed to be both heroes and monsters. And I kind of liked, maybe less so with Wanda. Really, for me, Wanda was the most sympathetic character of all of them. Also the most real, I think, in terms of not having this grand, fantastical journey that they get to go on. And yet kind of fits in together very well. But I think the huge amount of agency that the girls are allowed to have, but also the huge amount of complexity in terms of being able to be selfish, being able to be cold or cruel even sometimes, is a big departure compared to not necessarily even fairy tales, but just generally books about women.
And I think it's also interesting to see that change throughout the book as well, right? Because I think especially with Miriam and Irina, you see them growing to be these women that they are, you know, that they don't, they know that others don't care for them, so they're doing what works with them. And then you see them dealing with their family, accepting that part of them as well. Like Miriam, her mother was initially quite disappointed with how she turned out to be this sort of cold money lender who only cares about the debt that they owe and the debt that others owe to them. But then, you know, that slow acceptance that, well, this is who she is. And then with Irina as well, her father being... I guess there was one part in the book where the father says that he's proud of her. And, you know, just seeing that change from being the daughter that he did not want to being the daughter that actually he didn't think he wanted.
Mm.
And I don't know, I think there's a lot of girl power there in the sense that it was within each woman and not necessarily as like a group of them.
But it's also, I think, about how power is something that you can claim. Mm. Because in each instance, so the story hinges on a boast that is made by a character, you know, and how that boast then ends up being something that has her sort of taken away, and that really sets a lot of things in motion. And it's a boast that she thinks is idle, you know, that she thinks is only valid in her setting. And yet when she's taken away, it's a real power. She has actual magic. And that's something that I think, again, all the characters at different points claim magic. When Wanda gains literacy, she recognizes that as a certain type of magic.
Yeah. And magic not in just that conventional sense, but,
correct.
But magic as power.
That she claimed. Yes, and I think that there is something... So for me, there were things about the story, like I said, that mostly it worked. I enjoyed the read. I'm looking forward to Uprooted, actually. But maybe because I came in with the promise of a breezy book, I wasn't ready for what it was.
And be thrown into winter.
Yeah, literally winter and like abuse and horror and starvation. But what I really loved about it was exactly that, that it is a book of consequence and it is a book of you can claim your own magic. And that's a very strong strain. I really loved that.
And then really quickly, I think as a contrast, I think it really would be helpful to talk about also the other characters that kind of surround these women, particularly the men, because you have some very awful men, but you also have some really great men as well. So on the one hand, you have characters like the Tsar, who's looking for a wife, and that's really in Irina's story.
And Hans Squirrels.
Yes. And murders them, actually.
And tortures them as
well. Mernatius, that's his name?
Yes.
Mernatius, yeah. And then you have the Starik King.
The unnamed Starik King.
And then you have Wanda in a much more prosaic. You have her brothers, her father, and a very awful, abusive home situation. And I what I enjoyed is how even the men are not really painted as all villains or all heroes. You know, the ones who are great are also shown to be flawed, like Miriam's father, for instance, who is both loving and yet quite ineffective. And similarly for characters like Mernatius, who, I don't know, sort of is almost that archetypical YA, like, beautiful bad boy that you're supposed to fall in love with, but then becomes a lot more complex as you get to know him.
And even that also, that applies with the Starik King as well, you know, and I think for a bulk of the story, you see him as he is this cold king who's there to sort of, you know, take Miriam away as his wife, and to sort of, you know, come and steal gold from the people. But then as you dig deeper, there are so many layers to all these different characters that you just wouldn't see at the start.
So, we've been talking about Naomi Novik's Spinning Silver, which is not so much a retelling as a reconstitution of kind of the main themes of Rumpelstiltskin retold in the story. If you've read it, if you're planning to read it, or if you just like fairy tale retellings, let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. That brings us to footnotes. Sue Ann is still sticking around. Thank you very much.
I'm still here.
And you know, we've been talking about fairy tale retellings in some senses. And I think this is probably something that we can do for a longer show someday, because that well never runs dry. But we thought it might be nice to also talk about the first time you encounter an unadulterated fairy tale? Because the truth is, most of us read them in their abbreviated forms first, or have them read to us with our parents censoring all the good / bad bits. And the first time you read a fairy tale as it was truly told, it can sometimes be a shock, or at least that's been my experience.
I think it's difficult to run away from the fact that fairy tales, especially the Grimm's Brothers ones, or even Hans Christian Andersen, were never meant to be happy, happy, Disney-fied versions of stories. They were actually much closer to Spinning Silver in the sense that they're meant to be cautionary tales that just give you the hard truths about life. And so,
in the form of, you know, mermaids and princesses, but nevertheless.
I will say, though, that... In a weird way, the first time that something like that occurred to me was actually in a story that didn't really have to be or wasn't ever actually polished. I don't think I've ever heard a sanitized version of this story just because the core story is quite terrifying, and that's the Pied Piper of Hamelin.
What do you mean? I completely don't get what you're saying. Pied Piper is great. You know, who doesn't want to follow a merry man who just comes along
and then just disappears? I don't know whether then later I read It by Stephen King and it sounded so darn similar to what the Pied Piper could have been. That's why it terrified me. But really, that again, the idea of not repaying a debt, promising someone, it all goes down to this: what are fairy tales really about? And the reason Pied Piper scared me as a kid, one was because I read that Lady Bird version, which had this like these horrifying illustrations first of rats spilling over pages.
Yep.
Right? So that one. But then also the idea that that same person had the power to just take away all the children in the village. And where did they go? What happened to them? Nobody knows.
And he wasn't sorry.
He wasn't sorry.
Yeah.
But neither was he cruel.
No, it was just what he had to do.
It just is. So I don't think Disney's ever going to make a Pied Piper because, you know, but as a story, that's a pretty stark reminder that, you know, if you tell someone to provide you a service, by all means, pay them for it.
What about like a Pied Piper Ratatouille mashup?
My God.
Ooh. Sorry. I'm just, you know, I just want to somehow find
scared.
A way. Yeah, right? To make it happen.
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah. So in that same vein, okay. There, I first encountered fairy tales because I had a wonderful set of parents who both really enjoyed reading to me as I was a kid. It was a huge part of my, the ritual of my day. And my dad did all the voices and, you know, it was great. But there's some stories that just can't be sanitized. It's like you said, like fundamentally the Pied Piper is just woof, you know? And similarly, if anybody remembers The Goose Girl, which is one of the Grimm Brothers stories, guys, there is a horse named Falada who dies and is magical, and then its head is nailed up on the town gate and it speaks to its princess. So there's just, you know, it's very hard.
It's not Tangled.
It's not Tangled. And even when you have your dad doing all the cute voices of Falada, it doesn't change the fact that it's a godfather situation here, guys. So, you know, the Goose Girl really tells the story of... a princess who's off to be married, but then something goes wrong, all her stuff is stolen, and somebody else pretends to be her. That somebody behaves terribly. In the end, she finds a way through goodness and virtue and piety to getting that person, realized as a fraud, and then that person gets nailed and, like, punished in terrible ways. So what I'm saying is that this story has a lot of violence all the way through it, on its way to trying to tell you this thing about, well, don't tell lies, or you'll be like that evil girl who, you know, she didn't get flayed, but it's not that far off of that. Essentially, her punishment is dragged through town naked in a barrel with internal spikes.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay. That went dark very fast.
So that's what I'm saying, right? And that is exactly, I think, what you were saying earlier, Sharmila, about Grimm's Brothers and other sort
That's
of
the reason
old...
their name is Grimm.
Correct. And also all these older fairy tales where at the end of it, you're just like, well, I guess that's how it is.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to just take it as it is because there's no way to sanitize that. So...
Are you going to depress us too, Sue-Ann?
Yeah. Do you have something kind of...
Probably not too depressing. I think because from my childhood, most of the fairy tales that I saw, that I read or came across on TV, it was a lot of more of the sanitized version, or I guess fairy tales that are not so dark, you know, that you're just reading it to children for fun. You make a story out of it. And what I really liked was the 12 Dancing Princesses, where, you know, every night there's this king with 12 daughters and they all sleep in one room, and every night they sort of disappear, I guess, without the knowledge of their father. And then every morning when they come back, they're exhausted, their dancing shoes are just worn out, but no one can figure out what's happening. And that happens, that keeps happening. They're exhausted during the day, dancing shoes are worn even if they're new. And so one day the king sort of just asks someone in the kingdom to sort of come and, if they can figure out what is happening, they will win the hand of one of the princesses. And so you have someone who then has sort of an invisible cloak, I think. You're following the princesses down into this magical, fantastical land. And it's, I don't know, to me that was such a fun story because you're already imagining the story, but then in that story, you're also going again to another world where it's even more fantastical. You have people dancing and all these pretty things going around. And I think that really appealed to me because it's sort of a fantasy within a fantasy.
But it's also because I think, because I loved that story as well as a kid, and I think it's because it shows you that when you go to sleep or when somebody puts you in your room, it doesn't mean you have to stay. Yes. You know, because that's the story there too.
Am I just transposing my own perceptions of grim fairy tales onto this, that I feel like there is a darker version of that story that I can't quite recall? Something to do with the girls being punished and all sorts of things like that?
Well, guys, I'm sure, you know what? I'm sure someone will tell us,
yes.
You know?
Or I'll go look it up after this.
So, we've been spending today talking about Naomi Novik's Spinning Silver, and then after that, talking about, I suppose, a mixture of our favourite fairy tales, but also the realities of encountering an unadulterated fairy tale in its truest form. You know, when you first see it and you're like, oh, barrel and spikes, cool. Tell us, do you enjoy fairy tales? Do you censor the good bits when you read to your kids?
All the bad bits.
WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio, and please write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.